a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
Of the South Dakota Legislature. May we have a roll call?
Buell. Gibson.
Here.
Hayek.
Here.
Hunhoff.
Here.
Valley.
Here.
Johns.
Here.
Have a quorum.
The chair would entertain approval of the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the minutes of the June 4th meeting.
Second, Hayek.
Any discussion? Appearing that there is none, all in favor say aye. Well, let's do a roll call.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hayek?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Johns?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Do we have a staff report?
No report.
We'll proceed then with the review of the proposed rules. Representative Gibson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first agency to come before the Interim Rules Review Committee this morning is the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, the Board of Water and Natural Resources, and we are going to amend director areas in water development districts to redraw the director areas in the James River, East Dakota, and West Dakota water development district areas, amend consolidated water facilities construction program rules, amend state water pollution controlling revolving fund program, update or correct references to the Clean Water Act, amend solid waste management program rules, amend drinking water state revolving fund program rules, and lastly, update or correct references to the Drinking Water Act authorizing legislation, census data, and state statutes, and make other minor grammatical changes. So will our testifiers please come forward, identify yourselves, and begin your testimony.
I'm James Feeney, Director of Financial and Technical Assistance. I'll be providing some of the funding presentations.
I'm Pete Jarrus. I'm an environmental scientist manager with the Department of Environment and Natural Resources, and will be providing an explanation for the Water Development District rules.
Go ahead with your testimony.
Representative Gibson, members of the committee, I'm going to provide a brief explanation for Rules 7405-05-16, 7405-05-20, and 7405-05-21. The effect of the rules will be to redraw the director areas of the James River, East Dakota, and West Dakota water development districts. The reason for the amendments is due to the withdrawal of a portion of Minor County from James River Water Development District and to correct errors in the designations of voting districts in Minnehaha and Pennington counties. The draft rules have been reviewed by Legislative Research Council for style and form and approved for legality. LRC's changes were incorporated into the final version of the rules. No written comments regarding the proposed amendments were submitted, and I'm available for questions.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair.
On Chapter 7405-07, the Consolidated Water Facilities Construction Program.
Hang on just a second. Senator Valley.
Are we going to take them all at one time?
That's up to you. Would you rather...
Well, that's fine. I'll ask my question later then.
Okay.
All right, on the consolidated program, this is a state funding program. We're dealing primarily with updating rules to reflect the current process of the applicants submitting requests for a funding package rather than an initial consolidated grant request and then subsequent SRF state revolving fund loan applications. And the revolving loans are two of the other chapters that we're presenting this morning. In 2010, we changed the process where now applicants, and these are primarily municipalities and special purpose districts, submit an application for funding, a full funding package. We review the applications, present recommendations to the Board of Water and Natural Resources that has the statutory authority to make these funding decisions. As we've changed from an initial grant and then in a subsequent funding round, some of the rules are no longer needed. So what is before you today is the cleanup and some revisions to reflect that. Again, as noted, we had the hearing in front of the Board of Water and Natural Resources on these rules June 27th. There were no written comments. There was no testimony. And we have proceeded to this point. I guess I would at this time ask Mr. Chairman. I can go through these as we did at the hearing, more on a section by section. If not, I can defer for questions, or I can, I guess the third option is sort of a more global overview of how these changes came about and how, as a practical matter, they change, reflect our current process.
Committee members, would you like a section by section overview or just a general global overview? Okay. I see Senator Valley's head shaking with a general global overview, so go ahead with that.
All righty. I would direct you to page 19 in the rules. This is sort of the application review. What you see we're striking, again, previously had been minimums to be eligible for grant consideration. If applicants weren't at this level, we didn't even present the application to the board unless a waiver was granted. With the combined application, and again, our process is, quite frankly, is to look to see what the amount of loan that these applicants can leverage with their current rates or with a rate increase, and then look at the subsidy needed to complete the funding package. So in this section, we struck this material having to do with the minimums. What we have added and the waiver process at the bottom of page 20, we're outlining again what the department is doing with the review, a review of the financial status, the factors for decision making that are in rules in section 11, look at their financial capability, and then proceed with making a funding recommendation to the board. And that recommendation may be for a grant loan from this program or for other programs, whatever that project might be eligible for. And again, we're looking at drinking water systems would be eligible for the state consolidated program or the drinking water state revolving loan program. If we're dealing with sewer projects, they'd be eligible again under the consolidated program or the clean water the pollution control revolving loan program. So that is the crux of our change in our process. Then throughout this section, we have deleted some sections that were no longer needed, some references to code citations, and working with legal counsel on checking those. The recommendation from the assistant AG we work with was to delete those. So that's another group of these changes. And then there's one other change I would like to highlight, and that is the grant period. And that is in... that is on page 25, the time restrictions. We have increased this for these state grants from 3 years to 4 years, as we have a number of projects not being able to complete as there's delays in if there's other components to the funding package or just other delays weather-wise and so forth. We have recommended that, and the board concurred to make that change. I guess with that, at that point, I would stand by for questions specific to the consolidated program. I would note, and again, I apologize, it's somewhat disjointed, but if we can go on to the other chapters, the solid waste is somewhat different, but having to do with the water projects, I would note on jumping ahead to page 90, and this is under the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund Program, that on the top of page 90, subsection 5, the top of the page, the version in front of you and what was distributed struck or, and that should be left in, and we would make that change in our final rules to be filed with the Secretary of State, and we were told to note this at this hearing. With that, I will switch to the chapter on the solid waste rules.
Representative Hayek, did you have a question?
Yes, I did. I didn't know if he asked for questions in this particular section and we could ask them, or are we moving on?
If you have a question in this particular section, why don't you go ahead and ask it?
I do, and I thank you. As I reviewed this material, and I may be just a little bit overly cautious, but it seemed as though we were, with the 40% requirement from communities being scrapped, with the financial reporting, I've got a really strong, overburdening sense that we are eliminating the community responsibility and the requirement for the individual communities to really demonstrate the financial wherewithal to take on the issues. And I think of some of the other states and communities that we've heard about that kind of got in over their heads. Are we taking out really some very essential elements that would be a protective element, if you will? And I'd really like you to address that.
Okay, go ahead.
Representative Hayek, I guess two things. One, under SDCL 46A-161, there's already controlling language that grants out of the Water and Environment Fund, and that's where the consolidated grants are coming from, may not exceed 80% of the non-federal share of expenditures. So that was always there. Then we had this 40% of the total project costs, which was a percentage on a different element, and it was somewhat confusing and could be waived. But to the crux of your question, quarterly I go before the board and make funding recommendations. Quite frankly, they're always for probably pushing these applicants to a much higher rate than...
Representative Hyatt, could you please mute your microphone?
So, and again, our funding recommendations certainly, and the direction from the board, and I think the record on the awards made indicate that we are looking to the applicants, the municipalities, the special purpose districts, to make a significant contribution to this. This is primarily through loans, the state revolving fund loans. You know, last year we were we awarded more than $90 million under the Clean Water, the SRF program. I believe $20 to $30 million under the Drinking Water. But at the same time, we're making grants at a level of about $7.5 million. So I believe the board's record is very clear. As we provide to the legislature at the beginning of each session, the state water plan and the annual report does reflect why we do provide significant subsidy in some cases. Again, we're dealing with a lot of small communities in the state of South Dakota that have a limited number of users, so what they can leverage in loans is sometimes not a high dollar amount, but we do request that, and we are seeing most of these systems paying rates anywhere from the high 30s to $40 for whether it's a sewer rate or a drinking water rate. So I guess that is my response, is that we are looking for a commitment up to that community's ability to pay, and probably in most cases higher than they would like.
If I do, Madam Chair?
Follow up. Go ahead.
And I'm really concerned, like on page 26, the review of financial status, on 27, the environmental impact statement. Again, on to 28, we took out the Attorney General's involvement. On 31, any survey plans. a number of questions that you've just stated, I guess what my major concern is, that as long as you're there, things are under control. But when we eliminate all of these safeguards, we don't know who's going to be sitting in your place. Is it necessary to take them all out?
Representative Hayek, I guess the review of financial status, again, we have added that into Section 8.01. Regarding the environmental impact statement, SDCL 34A-9 still remains applicable. 34A-9-1 says all agencies may prepare or have prepared by contract an environmental impact statement on any major action they propose or approve which may have significant effect on the environment. And in that chapter, the definition of agency does include executive and administrative departments, offices, boards, commissions, and other units of state government. So the statement that is in rules that they may require this was there, but again, it is covered in very clearly in SDCL 34A-9. Certainly, I believe you also talked about some of the other things, the land survey, the review of plans and specs. Those are covered in other administrative rules or in code. We felt, we looked at this as having them restated in these sections were duplicative and were unnecessary as we tried to streamline and make this more of a good overview of how our programs operate at this point.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Any other questions by members of the committee on this particular section? Hearing none, we'll continue on then with the remainder of the information to be presented.
I would like to now go to 740510. This is the Solid Waste Management Program. It is not as closely related to these other funding programs, but I would like to highlight that in the definitions and throughout the chapter in the law implemented section, we are deleting reference to SDCL 46A-1-82. This code section deals with the establishment of the Environment and Water Resources Trust Fund, and that trust fund has never been funded, and this reference should have never been included in those rules. So that is something different in this one, in this chapter. I guess other than that, again, we're looking at things taking out that match requirement, but again, the 80% is still there, and we have handled these in a similar matter in that the board staff recommendation and the board may award a loan in lieu of a grant or some combination. We're also clarifying that we can work from applications under the Solid Waste Management Program to provide clean water SRF funding. There are certain situations under that clean water program where the water quality aspects of a solid waste program, this would have to do with the liners, leachate collection, and those type of things, would be eligible under the revolving loan program. There's significantly more funding in that than under the state solid waste management program to have that flexibility to provide funding from that other program does help the state dedicated solid waste fees go further. So those were a couple things different with this section that I would like to highlight. I guess with that, I would stand by for any other questions on these four chapters regarding the Board of Water and Natural Resources funding programs.
Are there questions of the testifiers on these particular rules by members of the committee?
Madam Chair.
Senator Valley.
Thank you. I'm going to go to the water districts. And what was the reason that that part of Minor County petitioned out?
That's correct, Senator Valley.
No.
He asked the reason why.
Oh, the reason why.
Senator Valley, it was a local decision. The eastern half of the county has been and continues to be in East Dakota for a number of years. The western half was added to James River, I don't know, 6 to 8 years ago. I believe they felt they were being taxed but not receiving any benefits from the district, as is their option. There was action by the county commission to put it on the ballot, and it was on the ballot and a vote to opt out of the district. That's the extent I know as far as the specific issues.
Follow-up, Senator Valley?
No, thank you.
Are there other questions regarding the James Water Development District changes in their director districts by members of the committee? Hearing none, are there other proponents for these sets of rules? Other proponents? Seeing none, are there any at any of the other sites? There are none in Pier. Are there opponents who wish to testify against these rules at any of the sites? Are there opponents to these rules? There's no one coming forth in Pier. Seeing none and hearing none, then we'll close this particular hearing to public testimony and move to committee discussion and or action.
Madam Chair, Senator Valley, I'll move that the review process on these set of rules by the Department of Environment and Natural Resources is complete.
Is there a second?
John seconds.
Representative John seconds. Is there discussion?
Just quickly, it appears that this is a streamline of the rules. There were some things that were duplicative. The other part is I saw the list of the people that were there, and there were several communities that were there or had their water or waste management people there, and there was no negative comments from anyone, so it looks like they have put the rules out to people to look at or scrutinize, and no one came up with any opposition. So for that reason, that's why I'm making the motion.
Representative Johns, any comments?
No, thank you.
All right. Then that the motion has been made and seconded that the review of the set of rules is complete, and our secretary will call the roll. Gibson?
Aye.
Hayek?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Johns?
Aye.
Motion carried. Motion carries, and we'll move on to our second set of rules that come to us from the Department of Social Services, the Division of Medical Services, and I'm hearing some feedback. Does somebody not have a mute button?
I have a mute button, Representative. They are moving me, this is Representative Hyatt, to a different room so that I can have a better setup. And so I am going to go there right now, and I just want you to know if you miss me, which you probably
okay, so we will take a 5-minute break here until Representative Hyatt gets to another meeting room. Which room, Representative Hayek?
She skated.
All right, we'll come back into session. Representative Hayek is in a new, more functional room. And the next group or the next section or next agency to testify before us at the Interim Rules Review Committee meeting this morning is representatives from the Department of Social Services, and the rules are dealing with the Division of Medical Services. They are rules to amend and remove outdated payment rate calculation information for in-state inpatient services and certain outpatient services, clarify that reimbursement for out-of-state hospital inpatient services and certain outpatient services is calculated at a percentage of charges, and some pharmacy updates dealing with the Department of Social Services. So we have two testifiers this morning. Please identify yourselves and begin your testimony.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Laura Ringling, Department of Social Services. In summary, these rules are being amended to align provider reimbursement with the department's appropriated budget for fiscal year 2014. In summary, these rules remove outdated payment rate calculations for in-state, inpatient services, and certain outpatient services. They clarify that reimbursement for out-of-state hospital inpatient services and certain outpatient services is calculated at a percentage of charges as appropriated by the legislature. And they specify that the dispensing fees for certain items dispensed by a pharmacy or public health service provider can be found on the department's website. The public hearing on these rules was held on June 18, 2013. We received one favorable comment on the proposed rules at the hearing. With that, I'll stand by for questions.
Thank you. Do we have questions from committee members regarding this rules package?
Madam Chair.
Senator Valley.
Thank you. Can you explain the significance? I realize it's not part of the rule change, but I'm in the overall trying to get a feeling out of the 30 discharges per year. Why that's taken into consideration, why it's not 20 or 40 or whatever.
Ms. Ringling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, Brenda Tidball-Zeltinger, I'm the Chief Financial Officer for DSS. In response to that, the class of the number of discharges is a mechanism that's been used simply to classify facilities as kind of our larger volume hospitals. So in this particular rule, those what are referred to as DRG or our larger hospitals are those that have the higher volume, more than 30 Medicaid discharges in a year. The other classification of hospitals, those that have less than and meet other criteria, are more our rural critical access hospitals that are smaller volume. So that's the classification basis is the number of discharges.
Follow up, Senator Valley.
No, thank you.
Are there other questions by members of the committee regarding this set of rules? Hearing none?
I have one, Madam
okay.
Chair. It's a general one.
Go ahead.
My question is kind of a philosophic one, and you know, you have people that will advocate, obviously, and keep track of the rules, what's happening from the South Dakota Health Organizations, and obviously they came and said that they were in favor of it. But who's standing in and saying, you know, looks at these rules and say, yeah, I think that the Medicaid patients are getting a fair shake here also. Is there any organization, is there any group that you mail these proposed rules to? I should say probably email. But, you know, we always have those advocacy groups out there that I think are very important, and they look at these and see how each group is affected by them. And is there an advocate for the Medicaid recipients?
Go ahead. Thank you for that question. What I would share with you is in terms of kind of, you know, how this information is distributed and making sure that there's awareness, you know, around these particular reimbursement issues. Yes, we actually began outreaching different provider associations across the state shortly after the governor's budget address regarding the impact of these inflation policy that was being proposed. And so certainly in the South Dakota, SADAHO, which is kind of your hospital-based group, the Nursing Home Association, the Pharmacy Association, which impact these particular rules, were outreached directly not only with information about the rule change, but way back during the budget request process to talk about what that would mean. And then these rules simply just support what the legislature adopted in terms of changes around reimbursement rates for those groups. So, yeah, there's a wide array of groups that we outreach and work with to ensure that there's awareness and understanding of the impacts of these changes.
Follow up, Senator Valley.
Just a quick one, we've got the pharmacists and we've got the hospitals, but how about the actual Medicaid recipient? Is there any group there would come in and say, you know what these rules do? Here's how they affect people that are on Medicaid. Is there anyone that's like that? Is there any group? I would say for Medicare, you'd have AARP that would come in and raise their arm and say, you're not treating us fairly here. For Medicaid, is there anyone out there? Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
That's a really good question, and I think that you will find in some particular coverage groups there is that advocacy. You mentioned AARP, and they certainly work with the elderly, impacts to elderly citizens in South Dakota, not just from the Medicare perspective, but also the Medicaid perspective. And so you do have groups like that. You don't see a wide advocacy group out there, kind of a general around Medicaid, but there are some smaller groups, Voices for Children, some other groups that tend to kind of help advocate. But unfortunately, I would say, I don't know that there's a real strong Medicaid, specific Medicaid advocacy group, but lots of pockets of smaller groups that tend to, impact in these areas.
Okay.
And do their best then to reach out to their constituents and work with the folks that they represent.
And the reason for my question, Madam Chair, is I'm not saying whether I'm for or against Medicaid or expanding it or cutting it or whatever. I'm just in all other areas we seem to have someone there that's kind of keeping an eagle eye on what's happening. And as I was reading this, I'm thinking, who's keeping an eagle eye out for the Medicaid person? And so that was the reason for my question. Thank you very much.
Are there other questions by members of the committee? To follow up on Senator Valley's question, then, I sit on the Center for Independence Board of Directors, which is the community support provider in my district, and they certainly would have gotten notice because I think most of our people served are serviced by Medicaid funding. So that would be an example. And the Advocates for Persons with Disabilities, would that also be another group that would get notification and weigh in on this particular change?
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, and that's, again, what I intended. When we have a wide array, probably 15 different provider groups that are impacted by, that relate with Medicaid. And those groups do certainly, while they represent, often are provider-based in their representation, they certainly, have that impact and kind of have that communication with the folks that they serve in those agencies, which would be, again, those community support providers, behavioral health providers, nursing home assisted living, senior meals, in-home services. So all of those provider groups not only are coming at it, I think, from the provider perspective in terms of what that's going to mean, but then certainly, relay that and communicate that information to the folks that they serve in their agencies. So I think that's it's kind of done more by service probably group, as opposed to, I think your question, kind of a broad, kind of universal Medicaid, overall advocacy group.
And if I may add to that, too, this isn't legislation. These aren't rules regarding the actual fees. It's the basis of reimbursement with the fees that we've been allotted. So, therefore, we're not making rules on what the fees should be, but just how they're reimbursed. Is that my understanding?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I mean, I think what these rules do is implement the really the rate of increase and the appropriate inflationary increases as part of that the reimbursement process.
Thank you. Are there any other questions by members of the committee of these two particular testifiers?
I do have a question. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Representative Hayek.
I am sitting down. It's very nice. Thank you. The question that I had as I review this really then will become a legislative function something that has been totally outside based upon just an added, it happened automatically. We've got the 33.07% of usual and customary charge. Now it will be a legislative function on a yearly basis. Is that correct?
Thank you for that question. What I would say is that the rate of change to the, you know, the rate of increase all of these services have always been directed and appropriated by the legislature. I think what we're trying to do is kind of strengthen that language around kind of how that comes about. And because you, you know, the process, the legislative process lends itself to, you know, an agency hearing, a discussion, and all of that around those rates of increase. We wanted to refer to that process so folks understood there was also that, you know, so it was clear that there was an understanding that, that's the mechanism by which these changes originate and come about.
Follow-up, Representative Hayek.
Yeah, I'm questioning then, not only do we talk about an increase, but there is the anticipation that possibly they could lower the reimbursement. Is that correct?
Thank you. I think what certainly there has been, and that's some of the outdated language that we're striking from the current rules. At that time, historically, back in fiscal year 2012, there were specific rate reductions. And so, yes, there can be situations where, you know, there are recommended reductions as opposed to increases, and either a reduction or an increase has historically been and would continue to be a part of that legislative process.
Follow up?
Thank you.
Are there other questions by committees, members of the committee? Hearing none and seeing none in peer, are there other proponents for this particular set of rules? At any of the sites, there are none in peer. Are there opponents or persons wishing to testify against these rules? Are there opponents? Hearing none and seeing none, we'll close this hearing then to public testimony and move to committee discussion and or action or further questions of committee members.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hunhoff.
I move to approve the process that's been completed for the review.
Senator Hunhoff moves that the review of the rules, this set of rules has been complete. Is there a second?
Senator Valley, a second.
Senator Valley seconds. So we have a motion, favorable motion and a second. Are there any comments? Would you wish to make any further comments? Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to say, this is a process. This is after each session when the department puts their policies in place for the dollars that have been allocated to Medicaid. So this just follows through what we have been doing on an annual basis, and as staff have responded, trying to make it in clearer language so that we can be more understanding. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Hunhoff. Since there is a motion and a second that the rules review process is complete, our secretary will take the roll. Hayek?
Yes.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Johns?
Aye.
Gibson? Aye. Motion carried. This motion is carried, and I will pass the fictitious gavel on to Senator Valley so he can review with you the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks.
Thank you, Representative Gibson. We'll now move to the section on the division of the or the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. We've got a whole plethora of different things here. We go all the way from golf carts, rules in parks, to the wild turkey season, to the early August goose season, to from the Black Hills to the Sand Lake hunting seasons, and then the name change from Blood Run Nature Area to Good first state park. We've got a whole and I almost forgot the West River Bobcat trapping season. So with that, I'll let you gentlemen get started.
Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, committee members. My name is Doug Holfer. I'm the director of Parks and Recreation. With me is Tony Life. Tony is the director of Wildlife. I'll cover the first four pages that deal with the golf cart legislation that was passed this past session, House Bill 1220, and then I'll turn it over to Tony. Let's start on page one, Rule 4103.02.13. House Bill 1220 directed Game Fish and Parks and the Commission to promulgate rules to allow unlicensed golf carts to operate on designated roads within the state park system. The new statute also required that the golf carts be insured, has a rearview mirror, headlights, and brake lights. It also allowed the commission to require the park entrance license on golf carts. Previous to this legislation, golf carts were not allowed to operate unless they were licensed, and electric golf carts didn't have the ability under current statute to be licensed. So that was the conundrum, if you will, that golf carts had. Under state law, all roads in the state park system are public highways, public roads. And under current state statute, up until House Bill 1220 passed, the only vehicle that would not be required to be licensed to operate on a state highway was a moped. There's a separate legislation that's been in effect for many years that exempts mopeds under 50 cc from having the requirement to be licensed to operate on roads. With the passage of House Bill 1220, the rules that you see before you are necessary and following through with the intent of the legislature. Subsection 1 there would simply point out the requirements that are required in statute and that an operator needs to have proof of insurance if they're going to operate on park roads. Subsection 2 acknowledges the statute that allows mopeds to operate on state park roads as well, even though they may not be licensed as a motor vehicle. And then going on to the end of that section, what the commission is proposing and what this rule will do will allow golf carts to operate on any roads within the state park system that are posted at 35 miles an hour or less. And then it would also make an exception in Custer Park where we would not allow golf carts, all of the roads in Custer Park other than in the campgrounds are posted at a speed limit of higher than 35 miles an hour. So those are the rules that the commission adopted to designate the roads as they were given the authority to do under the House Bill 1220, where golf carts could operate without being licensed. Going on to Chapter 410303, dealing with the park entrance license, House Bill 1220 also authorized the commission to require the park entrance license on golf carts, as they have the authority on all other motor vehicles to require today. First section, 4103.0302 in that, adds a section to describe on vehicles without windshields, which not only could include golf carts, but motorcycles, mopeds, scooters, and some all-terrain vehicles, the alternative to placing your park entrance license on the windshield. And the alternative, of course, would be to just be able to have the park license available for inspection as you enter the park. The next section that actually sets out exemptions and the requirement for the park entrance license would repeal the subsection 6, which currently allows mopeds to enter a state park without a park entrance license. Now, This wasn't directly part of House Bill 1220, but the commission is including this in the rule at this time, basically for two reasons. One is an issue of fairness. All other motor vehicles, and a moped is defined as a motor vehicle, even though it is an exemption to the law that requires it to be licensed to operate on the roads. But it is a motor vehicle, and all other motor vehicles now, including golf carts, are required to have the park entrance license. So for fairness sake, we're requiring it of mopeds as well. The other thing is that technology and design of mopeds have changed dramatically over the years, and it is pretty difficult to tell the difference between a moped and a motorcycle any longer. A lot of them travel 45 miles an hour and are fairly commonplace. So that exemption is being repealed as well. So with that, those are the rules that deal with the implementation of House Bill 1220 and the rules that deal with parks. If there's any questions, I'd be able to answer them.
Unless someone has a pressing question, if it's all right, I think we'll go and take the whole thing and then come back. Unless someone has a pressing question or word you're going to forget. If not, then we'll go on to Mr. Life and take up your section of the code here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, committee members. As Doug mentioned, my name is Tony Life. I'm director of the Wildlife Division. Here to present the rules adopted by the Game Fish and Parks Commission at their June meeting held in here in Pierre on June 6th and 7th. The next section that we the commission dealt with was dealing with archery restrictions that begin on the bottom of page 5 and on to page 6. This last legislative session, you and your fellow representatives and senators passed a bill that made an allowance for party hunting and party fishing. Many of you probably remember that this bill was specific to fishing and specific to small game hunting. There was a provision of that bill and now codified law that said specifically that the provisions of this chapter do not apply to big game hunting. What the rule changes that you see in front of you on page 6 and on into page 7 is consistent with that legislation that was passed this last session. The change that the commission made with this rule is it shifted the burden for this, in essence, party hunting for big game from the person who has the license to the person who does not have the license. That is what you'll see when the shift in language from 4106.0503 and replacing that language in 4106.0503.1. What it does, again, if two hunters in the field, one of them has a license, one of them does not, that is a violation of this accompaniment rule, and currently, as it sits, the person in violation is the one with the license, and again, the commission adopted these rules to shift that burden that the person who does not have the license would be in violation of this accompaniment rule. Next is the fall wild turkey hunting season. There are a few license changes that were made there and one cleanup. I'll draw your attention to the unit that's described on page 8 in subparagraph 2. About 3 years ago, we actually shifted or changed the West River unit from being county by county to a more omnibus unit that includes all West River counties, in this case except Harding County where the fall season is closed, and the Black Hills units. Prior to having unit by unit, county by county units out west, there was a rule that's listed on page 11 that you see as being stricken. Essentially what that did was there was a lot of turkey habitat along the Cheyenne and White River in the western part of the state and allowed hunters to utilize both sides or hunt both sides of those riverine habitats when they were out there hunting turkeys in the fall. It's no longer needed because they're not separate units any longer. So in essence, that is a cleanup to remove that provision in rule because we now have this omnibus West River hunting unit for all of western South Dakota. Next is the conservation order for the goose hunting season. This is the August season. The commission did act to expand the number of days and increase the bag limit. Now, this may sound familiar to some of you who were on the Interim Rules Committee last year. In essence, the commission already made these changes last year by emergency rule action once the Fish and Wildlife Service had approved some expanded opportunity for goose hunting. So to the hunter, this is not a change in rule, but procedurally, we needed to come back and have the commission take permanent action on these rule changes through the normal rule promulgation process, because emergency rules expire, I believe, 90 days after they are actually passed. So while these are changes, again, in rules, they will not be changes to hunters. These will be the same hunting season dates and bag limits that they had last year during the August management take. Next, we have a set of deer seasons, a number of them, including the Black Hills deer season, the West River deer season, and the East River deer season. In general, all three seasons, there's a slight reduction in the number of licenses. There are no other rule changes. So in essence, there are 20 pages of adjustments of license numbers that I won't spend any time going through in detail, other than to say again that there's the general direction in these license allocations are for a reduction in licenses. The majority of those reduction in licenses are in antlerless permits in response to some deer losses that we experienced this last year. Many of you are well aware of the issues we had with EHD, which is epizootic hemorrhagic disease, in particular had a significant effect in the southeastern part of the state and a fairly significant effect in the western part of the state. The difference was in the southeastern part of the state, we were closer to where we wanted to be with our management objectives, and with the loss of deer that occurred last summer, we had to take some steps to reduce the number of deer that were being harvested, and in particular, antlerless deer. In the western part of the state, we were probably still above management objectives in many of those units where the EHD had its greatest effect. So the reductions in licenses are less profound out there. There were some slight reductions, but once again, the disease was a bit of an assistance to us in reaching some of our deer management objectives in some of those units where we were hoping for additional harvest. That takes us all the way up to page 37. Again, I'd be glad to review any specific license change in those individual units. If you have any questions about those, at least I'll do my best to try to answer those you have. Other than that, that takes us up to the archery deer hunting season, which begins on page 37. Last year, the commission took action, and you approved rule changes that changed the late season opportunities for hunting deer. Those changes were made to only allow antlerless deer licenses to be valid late in the year. It used to be that any deer licenses converted to antlerless deer licenses later in the year. And again, that was a bit of an encumbrance for us to be able to meet deer management objectives in certain units because when it comes to deer management, it primarily functions around antlerless deer harvest. If you want to increase your populations of deer in a certain area, you want to restrict the number of antlerless deer that are being taken. And on the other side of this, if you want to reduce deer numbers, our goals and using hunters are to reduce or increase the number of doe that are shot, and increase harvest there will decrease the reproductive potential. So once again, on page 37, you'll see where we built some consistency there to protect does in certain areas of the state, and that only antlerless deer licenses are going to be valid late in the season. When it gets to the antlerless licenses themselves, again, we're attempting to manage for deer in different directions in different areas of the state. We, in essence, have three different areas of the state. We have an area of the state that's open to a liberal take of antlerless deer where we want to go ahead and reduce numbers. A second area is an area where we'll allow a very limited take, in particular one doe per hunter. And then we have a section of the state where we want to restrict antlerless deer take in its entirety. And you'll see those units described on page 38. Now, when you read these things on a piece of paper, it's a little bit difficult, but once you put them on a map, and for those of you that have seen the deer hunting application, these have been transferred into maps that are much easier for hunters to understand. But you'll notice that there are actually 11 counties and the Black Hills Fire Protection District are in a unit where no archery antlerless licenses are valid. And then there are additional 8 counties that are described in subparagraph 5 there where a hunter can take one antlerless deer. And then all the rest of the state is in the unit where a more liberal allocation is available to archery hunters that want to take additional antlerless deer. There are a couple special units for archery deer hunting that you'll see on the bottom of page 39 and on to the top of page 40, where hunters essentially use their license and then they get a free access permit to go into the Adams homestead area and on to the Gooder State Park. There are 5 licenses available in Gooder, and there would be 10 licenses available, which is down from the 45. Again, this is in that southeastern part of the state where we want to reduce antlerless harvest take and consequently are reducing the number of access permits on the Adams area, but maintaining the number of licenses in Gooder State Park, shifting those from antlerless licenses to any deer licenses. Next, on page 41, we have special hunting deer hunting seasons in the refuges, National Wildlife Refuges in South Dakota, and there was a slight adjustment to the opening date to the Sand Lake units that will open the second Saturday of November instead of the Saturday before the East River deer hunting season. Also, you notice that this is a season that is restricted to muzzle-loading rifles only. Last year, the commission adopted a rule change to actually allow non-magnified scopes to be used on top of muzzleloaders. This was in response to hunters that said, you know, the optics that come with some muzzleloaders are very difficult for some people to use. So the commission went ahead and adopted a rule change that said that it was all right to put a scope on a muzzleloader as long as it was a non-telescopic. So it's, I think they're called zero power scopes. So what this does is align the rules in the Sand Lake unit, and you'll also see that again on page 43 where the we have some muzzleloader only units on the Wabay deer hunting units. Again, back up just to page 42 for just a minute there, you'll notice that the consistency, again, of only having antlerless deer licenses valid in the season extensions or the late seasons would be built into the Sand Lake hunting season also. So it's just antlerless deer licenses that would be valid late in those seasons. Next, on page 44 is the Custer State Park deer hunting season. In essence, what we're doing, or what the commission did, was act to protect mule deer. Mule deer are one of the most visible wildlife that we have in Custer Park, and many of you realize that visitation and the ability to see watchable wildlife is a major reason a lot of people visit Custer State Park, and the action taken by the commission to essentially close the season on mule deer is in essence to attempt to protect these animals that are highly visible and highly valuable from their watchable perspective. On the bottom of page 44 are the rules pertaining to the youth deer hunting season. Those same refuges that have rifle seasons on them also, at times, in certain areas, will allow youth hunters with a valid license to come on and hunt. Essentially, these are access permits. Once again, the refuge does not have the ability to issue license themselves. That authority rests with the state of South Dakota. But the refuges do control access to their refuges, and the changes that you'll see on the bottom of page 44 and on to 45 in essence allow some of those refuges to allow youth hunters to come on to the refuges to hunt deer if they deem that appropriate for their management practices there. We also have some of those restrictions, again, pertaining to youth deer hunting. One thing we do allow is for a single license to be issued to youth deer hunters that can be used statewide without any restriction. So even those 11 counties that are closed to other antlerless take through archery deer hunting, and you'll see in a moment here they're also close to muzzleloader hunters. Youth deer hunters, we do give one license, or there is one license available to hunt statewide. If youth deer hunters want to take a second deer, the area of the state that is open to a second license is described on the top of page 46, and that excludes those 19 counties and the Black Hills Fire Protection District where those additional protections are in place that we just talked about with the archery deer hunting season. Lastly, the general muzzle-loading deer hunting season has the same restrictions that we just talked about for archery, so I won't go through in those in detail other than to say, again, there's 19 counties plus the Fire Protection District where some protections are in place to limit the take of antlerless deer with the desire, again, to see increases in deer numbers in those particular units. Lastly, Senator Valley did mention that part of the public notice did have reference to the bobcat hunting season and trapping season. At the June commission meeting, the commission took action to re-propose those rules and did not take any action to adopt those in response to some of the public comment that was brought forward. And they just yesterday took action on the bobcat hunting and trapping season, which we will be here to present to you, I believe, in mid to late August, the actual rule adoption for that bobcat hunting season. So despite there being a part of this public notice, the commission did delay action on that and took that action actually when they met here yesterday. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be glad to stand by for any questions on any of these rule changes.
Thank you, Mr. Leif and Mr. Holfer. I think at this point I didn't see anyone there, but I want to check. Are there any other proponents to these rules? Are there any other proponents to these rules, either in Pier or at the other DDN sites?
None in Pier.
Hearing none, are there any opponents to these rules in Pier or anywhere at any other DDN site? Any opponents?
No one in Pier, Mr. Chair.
Last call for opponents. Okay. We will now go to back to the proponents, Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. Are there questions by the committee on this set of rules?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Hunhoff.
Thank you. Mr. Hofer, I can't let you off. With the golf carts, what's going to be the process for seeing if the golf carts that are in the parks are in compliance with the insurance and that?
You know, one way we're going to ask for insurance compliance is under state law right now, you can get a duplicate license, a second or third license, if you have more than one vehicle, by providing your registration. When it comes to a golf cart that isn't licensed, for one thing, many of the owners won't have a registration, but what we'll require in that instance when they buy the park entrance license, if they're getting a duplicate, is proof of insurance, and that'll be the way we'll know whether they own the golf cart, and it'll also ensure that they have insurance. It's no different, though, than it would be out on the highway. Unless you have some violation or reason for an enforcement officer to stop you, you know, the requirement is really on the owner. And we're not going to stop every vehicle that comes into the park to see if they have insurance any more than the highway patrolman would stop every vehicle that's out on the highway. But when we do enforcement checks, we will check that if there's reason to be concerned about the operation.
Follow up?
Please.
Is there any consequence here for someone that for some reason is stopped and is not in compliance?
I believe that someone that's not in compliance would be subject to a Class 2 misdemeanor, and it would be up to whatever the standard fines would be if they are cited for a violation.
Thank you.
Further questions? Mr. Wolfer, I've got one that's just a follow-up to that. I don't own a golf cart. Haven't bad enough at golf. It's not worth the investment in owning a golf cart. But when I have one, do I get that same thing I get for all my other vehicles, you know, on the bottom of my bill when I pay it? They got those little tabs, and it says that it's my proof of insurance. Do I get something like that for my golf cart?
I believe from your insurance company you would. They would provide you a certificate of insurance when you purchase it for any vehicle, whether it be a boat, a golf cart, a camper, or a motor vehicle of any other type.
Thank you. Further questions by the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Is that Senator Hunoff or...
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I read the minutes, and certainly there wasn't, and, you know, I know there's discussion in communities. There wasn't anything about age for driving those golf carts or anything in the discussion that the GFNP had?
In the rule and in the statute, you have to be a licensed operator, which means in South Dakota that I believe at a minimum you'd have to be 14, and that would be a restricted license, and you'd have to be operating under the terms of that. Under an unrestricted license, I think you'd have to be 16. But in any event, children that aren't licensed to operate a motor vehicle would not be allowed to operate a golf cart either under this rule or the statute that the legislature passed.
Thank you. Just a follow-up to that, I don't know, if they're driving one of those scooters, do they have to be licensed to do that? I'm not familiar. Do you know?
They need to be licensed to operate on a state highway, which would include a park road of any kind. That's in statute, and obviously it's not a park rule. It's a statewide law that has been on the books for some time.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, follow up?
Go ahead.
Just to be clear then, okay, you said... On the state roads, but your park roads are excluded, are they not? Because they're not state roads other than Custer State Park. They're just park roads.
Representative Gitson. Senator, by statute, state park roads are all considered state highways. The exemption is in House Bill 1220, where it exempts the operation of golf carts under these rules in state parks only. That's an exemption that is unique to state parks in statute. The moped law is a statewide law, and the exemption is to all state highways across the state, where you're allowed, if you have a moped that has less than a 50cc engine, to operate without licensing. So, kind of apples and oranges there, but the answer to your question is all roads in the state park system are state highways.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
I couldn't hear who that was.
It's Representative Hayek.
Representative Hayek, go ahead.
Thank you. As being in committee when this came up, there was a lot of heated discussion in regard to the golf cart and having it on the roads, and I still have some concerns that rather than allowing them to be unlicensed, we somehow do some legislation that would allow for licensing of these, which is done in many states, and take care of the issue. I think all of the points that were made by Senator Hunhoff were discussed about the dangerous aspect, the helmets, they're open vehicles, how they're policed, and I do see this as a real concern, yet it passed the legislature, and that said, we have to somehow put rules in place. I have some concerns about it and would like that to be noted.
Thank you, Representative Hyatt. Further questions?
Mr. Chair, this is Representative Johns.
Go ahead, Representative Johns.
Thank you. My question goes to the ban on possession of firearms while archery hunting. It appears as though there is an exception allowing people to carry a pistol if they possess a valid concealed pistol permit. What's the logic behind that?
Representative Johns, thank you. The logic behind that is that there is a state statute that is, in essence says that the individuals can carry a concealed pistol, and it is not within the purview of administrative rule to supersede statute. So that exemption has to be in there based on what is in state statute.
Thank you.
Further questions by the committee? If not, I have three right now. One is we've gone to more two tags and less one tag for turkeys. Just by the number of permits, is that going to affect the number of people that can get a license, because it didn't look like some of them were being filled anyway? Are we limiting the number of people that get the opportunity to hunt by lowering the number of one license to an increased number of two turkeys?
Yeah, good question, Senator Valley. In essence, what we attempt to do is try to allocate those licenses first on the desired harvest that we want to get in that area, secondly on the demand for those licenses, and then thirdly, there's only so much space out there for hunters, especially with turkey habitat, which is somewhat isolated in nature in many parts of these West River and East River units for that matter. So the goal is, if you want to have enhanced harvest, you still can only fit so many hunters into that habitat or into those hunting areas, many times on private land. And so the desire or the goal with double tag licenses is to take those limited number of hunters that are available or the limited number of hunters that have access and get additional licenses in their hand to get additional harvest.
Thank you. My second one is, could you explain the goose hunting seasons and what the requirements are? I tried to get onto the one from the internet on the goose hunting season for August, and I couldn't find the application on the phone. It's probably just because I'm inept at learning how to navigate through the internet, but I couldn't find it. But some it requires a federal stamp, some don't, it appears. Could you kind of go through, there's three different seasons, it appears. Could you explain that for everyone?
Sure. Yes, thank you. Another really good question, and it's important to point out that the governing body, the primary governing body for all waterfowl hunting seasons is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. And what the service does is put sideboards out there under which the states can adopt hunting seasons in conformance with those regulations by the Fish and Wildlife Service. In essence, the August management take, as it's described here, is not a hunting season per se, as described by the Fish and Wildlife Service. The way we treat it in South Dakota, it is, in essence is a hunting season. By the strictest definition, it's not in the U.S. in the purview of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Secondly, there's a September season, which the service has provided sideboards again to allow the states to have that season, and that season is actually listed as a hunting season by the definition of the Fish and Wildlife Service, and has some liberal allocations of season dates and bag limits. Both the August and the September season are intended to target resident Canada geese. We have a substantial number of resident Canada geese that is above our management objectives and tends to cause problems with depredation on many crops. Last year, the department spent over $750,000 assisting landowners with goose depredation complaints, and it's our belief that it will be at least that much again this year. So our goal here is try to get some harvest with those August and those September seasons. And then lastly is the regular Canada goose hunting season, in which some resident geese may be harvested, but in particular a lot of migrant geese that are moving through the state end up getting harvested with that season. And consequently, there is a lower bag limit because it targets migrant geese as much as it targets resident geese.
Do I need anything to hunt in any of those areas that is different?
Sorry, I missed that part of your question. I recall now that you did say that. Yes, the since the August season is not technically a hunting season by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service rules, you do not have to have the federal waterfall stamp to participate in the August management take. However, to participate in the September season and the season that runs through October and in some cases all the way into February, the federal waterfall stamp is required. Both of those seasons, all three of the seasons, you are required to hold a state hunting license.
Thank you. And the changes, I'm guessing that the changes in the budget, I think there was $108,000 or $9,000, was that part of your budget that you presented when you went before the legislature? I see there was or is that not going to be a significant change to the game, fish, and parks?
I'm sorry, Senator Valley, which origin of money are you talking about there?
The in the filing of the changes, it stated there was a loss of $108,000 to the Division of Wildlife. And I'm just wondering, do you anticipate that in your when you make your budget presentations to the Appropriations Committee?
Yes, Senator Valley, we do actually do that. In fact, every summer we go through an exercise where we project license sales for the upcoming year. We start this at our grassroots with our staff in knowing what the management objectives for our different units are going to be, everything from elk to deer to antelope and small game licenses. And we do make those projections a year in advance. Sometimes there is unforeseen changes that make changes to those revenue streams that end up supporting the department. But by and large, our staff do a pretty good job of getting some numbers on the page that help us in our budget planning. And then again, yes, and the direct answer to your question, that's a part of our presentation when we visit with appropriations.
Okay, thank you. Further questions by the committee? Hearing none, we will close to public testimony and I'll open it up to committee discussion and or action.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that the review of this package of rules is complete.
Second, Hayek.
Okay. It's been moved by Representative Gibson and seconded by Representative Hayek that the review process on the sixth set of rules from the Game, Fish, and Parks is complete. Any comments on that motion? Hearing none, the secretary will call the rolls. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hayek?
Aye.
Hunhoff?
Aye.
Johns?
Aye.
Valley?
Aye.
Motion carried.
The rules process now is complete on these section of rules by the Department of Game, Fish, and Parks. And with that, I will turn the gavel back over to the chair.
Thank you. The Department of Agriculture did request to be removed from this agenda, which completes our business for today. Are there any announcements? Hearing none, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you, everyone.
Representative Johns, we have to vote on adjournment.
I would call for a roll call.
Can I have a motion first, please? I'll motion that we adjourn this interim rules review meeting today.
Second.
Roll call.
Gibson?
Aye.
Hayek?
Aye.
Hunhoff? Valley?
Aye.
Johns?
Aye.
Motion carried.
Thank you, everyone.
This is Hayek. Is there anything more we can know about the Department of Agriculture, since I've spent quite a bit of time preparing for that? Are we going to have it next month, or where are we?
Representative Hayek, the Department of Agriculture withdrew the original raw milk rules, and have resubmitted them, and will have another hearing on the raw milk rules on July 26th, I think. And they, depending on how that goes, they will then come before rules review probably in August.
Thank you. I appreciate the clarification.
It might be the 28th. It's later in July that the raw milk rules will be heard again.
Will that meeting be in Pierre?
That meeting is in Pierre, yes.
Thank you. There's not...